You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin. And today's episode is one that I have been excited about for quite a while. One of the top requests that I get is to revisit one of my old podcast's very first episodes. For those of you who are not aware, I had a horror podcast over 10 years ago called All Horror. We actually did really well for ourselves, and I got to discuss what I love most, which is horror movies, or movies deemed too extreme or too taboo for general consumption. I found that luckily there is a great deal of overlap between the worlds of true crime and horror, and you may have noticed the injection of horror into some of our episodes here on We Saw the Devil, especially lately, like in the last month or so. The episode that I am referring to specifically is an episode on a documentary film called Graphic Sexual Horror. Some of you may have listened to that old episode. I mean, it was up for quite a while and it's like 12 years old. In that episode, I and my two other co-hosts at the time discussed this film at length. The cover art alone is something that will burrow into your psyche and plant itself there for the rest of your life. It's not a horror movie, but it's actually just a documentary on one of the most controversial pornography companies of the last 30 years, Insex. Now, you may be wondering why I'm going to be covering a porn site. My reason for this is threefold. First, it's one of our top requests. Secondly, Insex was actually shut down in 2005 by the Department of Homeland Security. Third, there is an unmistakable link between violent pornography and violent offenders. Now, I'm not saying that it's a causal relationship, mind you, but there is a definite link between the two. And allow me to make it very, very clear starting out here. Insex wasn't a website where women were casually tied up with rope, engaged in whatever sexual act, and then giggled as the scene cut. This wasn't Betty Page level 1950s smut. I cannot stress enough how violent and shocking it is. The women were actually physically tortured in almost every single way imaginable and left with temporary injuries, cuts, and bruising. It quite literally looks like it was made by a serial killer. Think of the raunchiest porn that you've somehow ever witnessed or come across, maybe even just kink.com, which is, I guess, one of the more popular ones. Insex made them look like Care Bears. So seriously, it is really, really weird and dark stuff. First, I would like to give a shout out to our Patreon patrons because our true crime gift of the month, I bestowed this documentary onto them. And this is a documentary, I hadn't seen it in quite a while, probably 7 or 8 years. I actually own the special edition because I'm so fascinated by it. And it's just such a really just raw and visceral documentary. So I bestowed this documentary upon our patrons and forgot that there's, you know, a great deal of constant nudity and BDSM and naked women. And it's just, it was a mess. So kudos to all of our patrons for watching it, processing it, and actually coming back with some really good questions and observations, because I watched it myself again. I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that, but it's all right. So first, before we get into discussing the film, let's just lay down a baseline and talk about porn and a brief history of its legal status here in the United States. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, U.S. states were seeing scores of lawsuits testing local obscenity laws. In a major case, Jacob Ellis versus Ohio, a movie theater owner was charged with possessing and exhibiting an explicit film. Ohio's state Supreme Court was more or less like, we don't effing know. because of that, and no one could clearly define what pornography was, what obscene material was, a lot of these lawsuits popped up. One in particular in California made it to the actual United States Supreme Court after a publisher was convicted of distributing obscene materials. The Supreme Court ended up upholding his conviction, but also finally laid out the basic guidelines for jurors in obscenity cases across the board throughout the country. So these included three different points. One, whether the average person applying contemporary community standards would find the work taken as a whole appeals to community interest. Two, whether the work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct specifically defined by the applicable state law. Three, whether the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. The Supreme Court reasoned that individuals could not be convicted of obscenity charges unless the materials depict patently offensive, hardcore sexual conduct. This means that many materials dealing with sex, including pornographic magazines, books, and movies, simply do not qualify as legally obscene. So after the 1960s, like early and mid-1960s, we started to see a lot fewer of these obscenity law lawsuits popping up. And that's actually a full episode by itself as far as like the history of pornography in this country. But this is still one of the guidelines used to judge obscene materials in this country. And it's actually very, on a grand scale, we don't see it pop up as much as we did. That's pretty much where we will stop with this three-pronged definition of the basic guidelines for jurors in obscenity cases and how to judge it. I would also like to take a moment and state for the record that I am not attempting to make some overstated correlation or attempt to show causation between violent porn and crime. I mean, let's be honest, people, who among us hasn't watched porn? 1 in 5 mobile phone searches is for porn. And in one large survey, 98% of over 4,000 men reported having watched porn at least once. And the number is staggering for women as well, somewhere I think like 74%. So I just want to make it explicitly clear where I stand on this. So let's get into the movie itself. And this is directly from the back of the DVD case. Quote, "If you won't allow me to teach your children, then I will corrupt them." And that is a direct quote from Brent Scott, creator of Insex.com. In 1997, a former professor at Carnegie Mellon University started a phenomenon. The website he created, Insex.com, was devoted to bondage, fetish, and sadomasochistic scenarios. By the time the site was shut down by the Department of Homeland Security, it had 35,000 members who paid $60 a month to view its content. An often raw and shocking documentary, Graphic Sexual Horror is a fascinating look at the rise and fall of the world's most notorious violent porn website and an exploration into the dark mind of its artistic creator, Brent Scott, aka PD. Containing original Insex.com behind-the-scenes footage and candid interviews with PD, the models, members, and staff, this film almost dares you to watch, assaulting the eyes from its opening frames with violent images of moaning, crying women, bound, tortured, and terrorized. And that sounds really kind of overly dramatic, I think, to the everyday person, but it's not. That is actually a very, very, I would say, accurately written description of this film. What I find most interesting about this movie is that it was created and directed by Barbara Bell and Anna Lorenzen. Anna Lorenzen was actually a model turned producer for Insex itself. And Barbara Bell was a novelist, so between the two of them, this film is a fascinating documentary with an incredible amount of insights with the models who participated with Insex, and it has an incredible amount of behind-the-scenes footage. Lorelei Lee and Princess Donna are two very well-known, near-legendary figures in the BDSM scene, and both got their start as models at Insex. This film shows nearly every aspect of Insex, from its early work, new models, their interviews, and live and recorded shoots and recollections. Color me boring and vanilla, I guess, but I'm not into this stuff at all personally. And I'm not one to kink shame, at all. And I think why I'm so fascinated by this documentary and topic in particular is because so many of the women who did such extreme acts did so because they felt empowered by it. I'll very briefly touch on the varying schools of feminism in a moment, but for me personally, in sex and the materials that it created, it walks such a fine line, guys. I am one of the most anti-censorship people you will ever meet, yet I'm also a major true crime junkie. And it's actually kind of disturbing knowing that tens of thousands of everyday people are paying large amounts of money, more or less, to masturbate to porn that is quite literally out of a serial killer's handbook. And this is probably my own preconceived notions and assumptions on this, but that's just where I'm at, okay? The film does not directly ask the viewer questions about the morality of incest, BDSM, or pornography in general. Nor does it actually pass judgment on PD, the creator, or his work. It just simply asks you to draw your own conclusion. So let's get into the documentary. Brent Scott was the founder of Insex, and the film obviously begins with him and his origin story. He went by the name PD, so that is how I will refer to him from here on out in this episode. Once, when he was a young boy, around 9 or 10 years old, he was playing outside with his cousins. And two of his female cousins loved Wonder Woman, and they had the whole costume for her, the hair, the outfit, the whip. So one day, as he was playing with them, they tied him up and tickled him. You know, just run-of-the-mill childhood play. He recalls having to urinate pretty badly and thought that he was about to pee himself. Well, he didn't pee himself. He had actually orgasmed for the very first time. And he describes how, as he got older, he would seek out bondage magazines or even advertisements showing women in bras or anything that made them look distressed or uncomfortable. He ended up being drafted into the Vietnam War and, while stationed in Japan, went out to a restaurant with fellow soldiers one night. The hostesses were wearing beautiful kimonos, and everything appeared to be just, you know, a normal dinner. That is, until a man grabbed one of the hostesses, brought her on stage, and slowly disrobed her. PD was shocked, but watched as they tied her up with ropes and put her on display. And he would later learn that he witnessed a form of Japanese bondage theater utilizing shibari, which is a method of Japanese rope bondage, and how they tie the ropes and things like that. It's apparently very ceremonial. So after the Vietnam War, PD came back and then went to college. And while working on his undergraduate degree, PD became obsessed with BDSM. I mean, he already was, but he was actually an adult now and able to, you know, more so act on it. Having had an interest in painting since he was young, his obsession was put to canvas. He began to paint. All of his paintings reflected his obsession with BDSM. The clips they display in the documentary show handfuls of darkly tinted paintings showing women in various positions, all naked and tied up, with either ropes or leather hoods or high heels. PD at that moment realized that he wanted to dominate and torture women. So he got married, and shortly after the wedding, he began to work on his master's degree. And during this time, he had a BDSM playroom. Literally, he had a BDSM playroom in his attic. His wife apparently wasn't into this scene whatsoever. So he just had his own little, apparently he considers himself a dom, he had his own little playroom in the attic. So what he would do is he would place ads looking for fetish models who were into BDSM and then brought the said models home to photograph them. He would tie them up in shibari, put hoods over their faces or heads, or just pose them into physically compromising positions. And at first, it was actually about the photography. He ended up becoming a professor of art at Carnegie Mellon University, and the university was well aware of all of his side projects. His entire portfolio and ongoing work at that time was solely focused on and dedicated to hardcore BDSM. And that's another crazy piece to me is imagine this incredible university and the art teacher, one of the art professors, literally his life's work is drawing pictures of women with those leather hoods over their heads or being restrained or kept in a cage. that was his artwork. And Carnegie Mellon was like, yeah, sweet dude, bring it on. Also during this time, Petey became very frustrated with the fact that he was married and couldn't sexually interact with the models. So he made a deal with his wife. He would be allowed to manually stimulate and masturbate the actresses to orgasm, but they could not touch him. So that's what he did. He would suspend a girl from the ceiling or put her on a forged crucifix. He would spank or cane her and then stimulate her to orgasm. He would also photograph and video all of this. At this point, this was pretty much consuming all of his free time, and he was utterly disgusted with his regular 9-to-5 life and being a professor at Carnegie Mellon. He had credit card debt piling up, and he was just overall miserable, and with the internet, anything was possible. So he took the remainder of his credit, plus his entire life savings, and he decided to create and found a BDSM website. He named it Insects, which he, with no apparent explanation, says is a play on the word insects, like bugs. Now, in this documentary, it actually interviews and has a panel of people who worked for Insects. We have everything from men, women, riggers, set designers, people like that. So the very first person that's up is Sid Black, and he became a rigger for Insects, or a handler as well. And he said this about the discovery of Insects when he was in college. He said, quote, "When I came across Insects, there was something kind of serial killery about them. Very grainy, gritty, very dark. I'd never seen anything like it. I couldn't tell if it was real or not. It looked like the guy really could have gone out, captured some girls, taken them back to his apartment, and done whatever he wanted to them." Sid was a broke college student who had a fetish for extreme BDSM. He said that he happily gave up beer and food money to pay the $60 monthly subscription fee to the service. To put that into perspective, in the mid-90s, a $60 subscription fee was the equivalent of $104 today. For a college student, that was a substantial amount of money. Sid becomes an interviewed subject in the film, offering information and observations from his time with Insects. Another key interesting piece to me is that when asked if Insects was porn, PD, the creator, replied and said, "No, absolutely not. It's art." And that quote then transitions to Barry Goldman, another former Insects employee who sleazily comes across as your stereotypical porn producer, even though he wasn't. He says, quote, directly, "Fucking A, it was porn." And Barry, unsurprisingly, advised Brent to get a wide variety of models in terms of ethnicities and backgrounds. That is something that Petey maintains to this day, is that Insects wasn't just a pornographic website. He considered himself to be an actual artist. In the world of BDSM, he considered himself to be an artist, not only in coming up with ways to torture the models and display them, degrade them, but also his artwork, his photography. You know, he put initially a lot of thought and time into framing the shots, what he wanted it to look like, and things like that. The film then shows different video clips from the earliest period of Insects, including numerous clips of models who responded to ads and then came in to be interviewed. They were asked their size, their sexual interests, their level of exposure to BDSM, as well as their hard limits. Now, a hard limit when dealing with the porn industry is basically a limit that you have. I will do everything up to this point. You know, slapping me is my hard limit. I do not want that. I will be done. Like, that is my hard, absolutely not limit. So that is something that PD always started off with in the interviews, is asking the girls what their hard limits would be. And that was actually fascinating as well, because there were so many different types of women who showed up to this stuff. There were women who were looking for just fast, easy sex work, easy being completely subjective there. There were alternative women wearing dog collars and leather and chains who were already deep into the BDSM community. And then there were also feminists and intellectuals. I mean, some of these women were even doctoral candidates at Ivy League universities. Some of them believed that modeling for Insects was a great way to reclaim their own sexuality on their own terms. There were countless reasons why women applied to the ads and wanted to be on screen. One model explained it that because the nature of it was so extreme and could actually, in fact, lead to physical injury, she felt like she was reclaiming her own sexuality because she was solely in charge of it herself. Only she could say her safe word and get out of that particular predicament, that situation that she was in. So she felt like she ultimately held that power. Some of the women are now quite well known. There's Lorelai Lee, who became a successful BDSM model and actress, and even more recently did a Hollywood film called About Cherry with James Franco, Lily Taylor, and Heather Graham. She graduated from San Francisco State University in 2008 and later pursued a master's degree in creative writing at NYU, New York University. She's highly intelligent and articulate, is a highly awarded writer, and has produced several of her own documentary films. Then there's Princess Donna, who is considered an absolute legend in the adult entertainment industry. She, like Lee, began to model at NSEX while an undergrad at New York University, later enrolling in the prestigious Tisch School of Art, which is incredibly, incredibly difficult to get into. She gained employment at NSEX, became one of the most popular models, and then later ended up working at the notorious kink.com for several years, leaving in 2014 to become a sex-positive educator and writer. The film hammers home that every single model was treated with respect, decency, and had their hard limits respected. And that is until they weren't, but we will tackle that as this episode goes on. Perhaps the most disturbing piece of this film is an interview with Model 101. That is her name, Model 101. What happened is PD quickly discovered that because NSEX grew so quickly, so fast, any model who came onto NSEX could leave, use NSEX in their resume and their porn name. I mean, for lack of a better description, their porn name. So he decided, that's bad for business. I'm going to give the models numbers. So say model, you know, model 101, the month that she came in for her test screening, followed by like the day. So 101 would be like January 1st. So that's actually how he numbered them. I mean, incredibly, you know, bold business decision there. But we can't deny the symbolism of assigning these women numbers instead of names. Model 101 is sincerely depressing because the film actually shows footage of her from her college years back in the mid-1990s. And she was beautiful, vivacious, full of life, her eyes lit up, and she was very articulate. She was a college student with a minor drug habit who was interested in BDSM. She joined NSEX solely for the money and was so popular that PD asked her to become a resident model. Now, a resident model was one that lived at the facility and more or less became PD's full-time plaything after the camera stopped rolling. You see, PD's wife had ended up divorcing him because he changed as a person after the official founding and success of NSEX. He was now free to sexually harass or engage in any various activities with any of the willing models off camera, and Model 101 became his girlfriend. It's quite shocking as the film transitions from footage of her bright-eyed and beautiful to how she ended up post-NSEX. She slipped into complete drug addiction, homelessness, and had multiple psychiatric hospitalizations. You know, she's sitting on a dirty, ripped up armchair. She's taking these long draws off a cigarette. She's got that 1,000-yard stare like she was in Vietnam and had just witnessed like her friends blow apart. She ends up saying, as she's staring just off into space, the torture stuff was a release. It dissipated the depression a little bit. And it's chilling. It's sincerely chilling. While doing research for this episode, I actually found an article that Model 101 had written discussing her life and time at NSEX. She described a childhood filled with physical, sexual, and emotional abuse and how it led to her feeling worthless. And she ended up actually getting into a sexual and romantic relationship with PD, which included being a 24/7 sub to PD's dom. And what he subjected her to off camera is more graphic than even I feel comfortable discussing here on this podcast. I mean, it's just absolutely depraved what he did to her. And you look at her now and she is just an absolute shell of a human being. Now, incest was unique for a couple different reasons. First, it was the most extreme porn that you could find on the internet at the time. Secondly, again, the models didn't have names, they had numbers, which made a huge difference. And third, the website had photographs, video, and live feeds. And the live feeds were without a doubt the biggest draw. Models would do live sessions, which back in 1995, 99, 2000 was incredibly unique. And these were really, really, really rough. Now, what you have to understand about incest is that the models weren't there, you know, every week or doing shoots. They had one model come, and she would come from somewhere all across the country. Most of these models didn't even live locally to the incest compound in New York City, because what they did left them with scarring, bruising, and pain. They would have to pick a model and then do a shoot with her, and then she would have to have months to physically recover from it. So the live feed was especially, especially bad. The sessions would last anywhere from 3 hours to 48 hours in total, just depending. There was a chat room on the page, and that chat room was actually projected onto a wall of the set that they were using so that everyone can see it at any time. An electronic voice read out all of the comments coming from subscribers, and people could pay for and request any sort of torture or action to be given to the model at any time. The live feeds would inevitably be the most extreme because of this, and obviously the result of that is that it brought in the most money. Women had their breasts and nipples pierced. They were caned until they bled. They were slapped, punched, suffocated with plastic bags, urinated or defecated on, had medical instruments inserted into their vaginas, pens, like sewing pens, inserted beneath their fingernails halfway up the nail bed, and penetrated with a variety of crudely fashioned sex toys. It was incredibly violent, and at its height, over 35,000 people paid to see these women utterly destroyed. And like me, you may be thinking, why in the hell did these women voluntarily sign up for that? In one word, money. The models were always paid extremely well. The base rate for even just a photo shoot was $300 an hour. For a live feed at that rate, a model could make anywhere from $300 up to $15,000 in a single weekend. Using inflation, that's between $500 and $27,000 over the course of 2 days. The more violently they allowed themselves to be abused, the more money they made. In a quote that was particularly telling, at least to me, Petey reflected on his own interests. He said, quote, "I've always been aware of the fact that this could be used as some kind of tutorial for some sick freak out there, like the gags I apply to girls. But then at the same time, I was influenced by criminal freaks. DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, they would pose the girls, the Hillside Strangler. I know these guys, these serial killers, and the ones who are the most fascinating to me are the ones who used bondage. Cameron Hooker was, in fact, the bondage freak who became criminal. Petey actually hired a full-time builder and welder in order to create different contraptions and set pieces for his films, and that was another thing that set them apart. Some of these were metal high heels that looked industrial or painful. Others were crucifixes, metal cages, posts, tanks. He would, and this is factual, look at serial killer material available online and then have his builder make it. And from his own admission, one of the biggest examples of this was sadist Cameron Hooker, who kidnapped Colleen Stan and imprisoned her in a coffin-like box under his and his wife's bed for over 7 years. He had an extreme BDSM fetish, kidnapped Colleen, and then built various contraptions in which to torture her. PD recreated one of his boxes for his shoots at Insects. He also has a love for horror films, such as The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Last House on the Left. He claims that horror movies exploit violence, so why is what he's doing any different? That's his logic. Midway through the documentary, though, the cracks begin to show. PD neglected safety protocols, leading to an 8-foot-tall tank of water framed by only 3/4-inch glass, shattering during a shoot with the model restrained and submerged inside. They have a tank. It's about 8 feet tall, this tank in particular. They are actually dunking her and submerging her in it. And she believes truly that she's going to suffocate and die. And the sheer panic and fear on her face is so palpable and just sincerely disturbing that there were people watching that in real time getting off on it. But that tank, because PD neglected safety protocols and the glass should have been thicker, so as that model was submerged, the glass shattered and she came pouring out of it. I mean, it could have killed both her and the other person standing in front of the tank, like the filmer. That easily could have killed someone. He also began to ignore the hard limits of his models. In one clip, which was captured on camera, PD slapped model S4 hard across the face. And you immediately see her trauma response engage because that was her one sole hard limit. That was it. No slapping me. Through the tears, she reminds PD of this, but then he humiliates her because it was a live feed. He snarls at her saying, "But the problem is, I can't tell you every little thing that's going to happen." She doubles down on it being a limit, and he argues with her and degrades her before finally relenting and agrees not to do it again. Multiple insex handlers and models also admit that Brent tried to pressure models into, quote, playing with him off camera. By that, he meant urinating on them and allowing him to have sex with them. He would tell them that he was feeling uninspired, but that if they played with him, he could use them as his muse. If they refused, he would make threats about their job security. It also became discouraged to use your safe word at all. It was considered a sign of weakness. One model, 1204, who was more of like the feminist and intellectual of the group, set her hard limit at anal sex. She'd never done it before, had no interest in it. During a live feed, JD used a metal dildo on a pole and violently, anally penetrated her without lubricant. She said that she, quote, felt that she was raped, but she still never safe-worded because she was scared to, because she knew that not only would she not be invited back for future jobs, and it was a lot of money, but that at that point, it was pride. Some of the sets for insects at this point were also becoming even more unsafe. They built another water tank and added leeches to it so that models were completely suspended and restrained in the tank and leeches were actually attaching to them. They were on a farm. They had moved to a compound outside of New York just in the countryside. And it was wintertime and they did a whole series of women outside in the snow where they would be completely naked, attached to a pole or handcuffed or with a collar on, literally knee deep in snow for a long time. One model in a barn was forced to stand, not over, but directly stand on a block of ice. And again, guys, remember that these women did in fact have the ability to safe word and get out of it. And around this time, if you recall, President George W. Bush campaigned in 2000 against the porn industry. That was, God, Guns, and Gays. So the porn industry was one of his big things, which is, you know, usually a conservative rallying point that it's corrupting the youth, so on and so forth. And this has been going on since, like, God, forever. And going against a $13 billion industry was pretty much an impossible task from the get-go. So the FBI began to focus on smaller operations. Because pornography could no longer be prosecuted under obscenity laws, the Department of Homeland Security under the Patriot Act determined that pornography was one of the main funnels used to fund terrorism. So they had the credit card companies start to drop all of these different websites. In 2005, the government used the Patriot Act to refuse PD the access to process credit cards because he was told violent porn sites were, again, known to funnel money to terrorists. So insex crumbled. The documentary shows all of these contraptions and machines that he had built were filled with cobwebs and dust. And that was insex. A bunch of them, like Sid Black, PD, and a bunch of different models, went on to go to various different fetish and kink websites, kink.com, Hogtie, all of these random ones. But insex was gone. Literally, insex just completely came onto the scene, all of this. I mean, it literally made history in terms of society and culture on the in the history of the internet. And then it was just gone overnight. That was it, just payments pulled. And this is a death knell. And this happened actually to a lot of different pornography sites online. Because if you think about it, even in 2021 with the internet, imagine that credit card capability was shut down on Netflix. And Netflix said, well, we can't process your credit card, so we need you to mail in a physical check. You know, wait the weeks for it to get here. Wait a week for us to process it. And then after that, we will send you, physically mail you a password to log in. So obviously people aren't going to do that. So InSex died basically as quickly as it exploded into public consciousness. Now, when you're talking about extreme pornography, violent BDSM, particularly like sadism, the entire discussion would be incomplete if you didn't discuss the father of it. This episode is going to be about the Marquis de Sade. A lot of people actually don't know much about him. They may have seen the movie Quills, starring Kate Winslet and Jeffrey Rush, that basically showed about his later years. Let's actually talk about one of the craziest people in human history. I mean, he was fascinating, horrible, yet some of his legacies may actually surprise you. So let's talk about sex, sadism, and let's go with the American Psychological Association's definition of this. Pleasure through cruelty and inflicting pain, humiliation, and other forms of suffering on individuals. The term generally denotes sexual sadism. In the classic psychoanalytic theory of Sigmund Freud, sadism is attributed to the working of the death instinct and is manifested in innate aggressive tendencies expressed from the earliest stages of development. For example, during the oral biting phase, an infant expresses sadism by taking pleasure in biting. Now, sadism was constructed after the infamous French philosopher and writer, the Marquis de Sade. The Marquis de Sade, or as he shall be known in this episode, the Marquis de Sade. And if you haven't, for some reason, heard of him, do yourself a favor and actually do a little bit of research. There are a handful of books on him. He has quite a storied history, and there's almost 0% chance that you haven't learned of his impact even indirectly. There's the infamous movie, The 120 Days of Sodom. There's the Hollywood movie Quills. And in terms of true crime, Myra Henley and Ian Brady reportedly loved going to the library in order to read his work. Specifically, Ian Brady would send Myra Henley in to actually check out books by the Marquis de Sade and his writings. Born in 1740 into nobility, he became known as a passionate and rambunctious child. And around 10 years old, he was sent to a Jesuit college, the Lycée Louis le Grand in Paris, where he spent 4 years. And there, he was subjected to corporal punishment in the form of flagellation. He was made to bend over a desk or a chair, and then they would flog him around his bare butt and his legs. It's said that during this time, he also witnessed his aunt having sex, and he was immediately beaten for being a voyeur. Either way, his pathological intersection between pleasure and pain began around this age. At age 14, he went to an elite military academy, and by 16, he was shipped off to fight in the Seven-Year War. He was highly decorated and known for his recklessness as well as his bravery, and he ended up returning to Paris in 1763, just as the war ended. At that time, he was considered a bachelor and basically more or less a hero to some degree. He courted a rich magistrate's daughter, but the dad was like, nah, here, take the ugly one. And he offered her older sister. So they married and eventually had 2 sons and a daughter. One can imagine that the man whom the term sadism is coined after was into some really grody stuff. And that would be true. He was known very openly as a libertine. And a libertine is someone who basically has no moral or sexual restraint. Do as you wish. A lot of people at that time used religion as their moral compass. So most libertines are staunch atheists, and they do not believe that man should live by any sort of moral or sexual restraints. The Marquis de Sade became notorious for his sexual appetite and exploits. especially while he was married. He would travel through Paris and the surrounding towns, searching for and going to each brothel in the area. And because of his desire to flog and beat and otherwise degrade the prostitutes at these brothels, he established a name for himself in the underbelly of Paris. And it wasn't a good one. He would kidnap women from brothels and bring them back to his residence, where he would then tie them up, sometimes drug them, and then rape them. He became so well known for assault that Parisian police would preemptively warn brothel owners about allowing women to leave with him. Like, the popo, I guess, would like just stroll up on horseback and be like, the Marquis is on the move. You need to tell your girls not to go with him. Now, a lot of members of the public, many members of the public, went to the police to report basically the like effed up shiz that he was into. Either through one-night stands, kidnapping people, his visits to a brothel. Everyone pretty much knew about it, and he made no attempts to hide his proclivities. So De Sade was finally put under surveillance by police, who logged his movement and his activities. Finally, on Easter Sunday, 1768, there was the Rose Keller incident. Oh, Rose. Rose was a 36-year-old German immigrant and widow. Her husband was a baker, and he had actually recently passed away, causing her to lose everything, become destitute, and she was living on the street begging in order to basically survive. So De Sade, now 28 years old, approached her and asked her if she would be interested in becoming his maid, his hired help. And so the two actually had a fairly lengthy exchange, and he was like, my bedroom. And she was like, I'm not that kind of woman. You know, like, what exactly do you need my services for? And he basically said, no. It's completely legitimate. I just basically need house staff. So Rose agreed, and they both set off to the Marquis de Sade's residence. Unsurprisingly, upon arrival, she was immediately led to his bedroom. And poor Rose still believed that he was just going to show her where he needed her cleaning assistance. So Rose was initially completely unconcerned. That was until De Sade orders her to take off all of her clothes. She asks him why, and he says to, quote, have fun. She tells him that she did not go there for that. So then De Sade drew his knife and threatened to kill her if she did not have sex with him. So he then tied both her arms and her legs to the corners of a four-post bed, and he then took his time slicing her body with a knife and poured hot wax all over the wounds before raping her. When it was all over, Desaad's demeanor changed entirely. He held Rose as she cried and put ointment on her, at that point, then bleeding wounds. He untied her and instructed her to clean the blood out of her clothes in a wash basin, and then he just left the room and locked it behind him, essentially imprisoning her, trapping her there. And in a badass bitch move, Rose traumatized, and she still managed to pry open a window with a piece of furniture that she broke off, and she used the bed sheets and some of her clothing that she tied into a makeshift rope and then lowered herself from a third-story window to the ground. Are you tired of the guess and test method when it comes to hair care? Formulate is the world's first personalized hair care formulation chemistry service. Work with your chemist to design the best shampoo and conditioner you have ever used. Each custom formulation is designed based on your own unique characteristics and adjusted based on your feedback and progress. Head on over to www.formulate.co/podcast. Complete the brief hair questionnaire and use my code DEVIL at checkout. Order today and you will get the second order free. Once again, that's www.formulate.co/podcast and use my code DEVIL at checkout. Or you can follow the link below in the show notes and description. So she immediately went to the police, and that was the final break that they needed. So Marquis de Sade was immediately arrested and interred in the Chateau de Semur, which was then a prison. And side note, this all happened less than a year after he married his wife. So he spent less than a year in prison, was released, And then immediately upon his, I guess, release, was like, YOLO, and immediately went back to doing the exact same thing. Frequenting brothel, kidnapping women. So eventually the police were like, we can't handle this anymore. And he was eventually exiled back to his residence outside of Paris in 1772. His wife and his primary staff remained behind at their Parisian residence, their residence in Paris. So now de Sade was all alone in a big house, like residence, completely by himself. What does he do? He wasted no time looking for new staff. Even though he was confined to house arrest, and for the most part, he did abide by that, he skirted this by basically continuously hiring servants that he repeatedly tortured and raped. Police, upon hearing this, because what would happen is he would hire someone, he would drag them into his like sexcapades, mass orgies, people and aristocrats from Paris would actually even visit him. And he was notorious for mass orgies and actually forcing his own staff to participate in it. So staff would constantly be leaving and going to police and being like, hey, this crazy bastard over here made me do X, Y, P, and Q. So the police finally, once again, began to surveil his residence. Now, in the ultimate display of a mom protecting her shitbag son, and we've seen a million of these, right? We all know the person or the mom who has the shitbag son who has like arrest warrants a mile long. He would literally beat a kitten if it meant getting him like whatever he wanted, drugs, car, stealing. We've all met the mother who's like, I love him and will just do anything for him. So that was Marquis de Sade's mother. She didn't care how many women he raped, tortured, whatevered, drugged. She was like, I love my son. What does she do? She actually goes and secures a royal order protecting him from the jurisdiction of the courts. What that essentially means is that it's an order directly from the king or the royal court, in their own words, basically saying this man is so important that the courts can't touch him. It essentially made him free to subject any unsuspecting person to his sexual whims and desires with no repercussions whatsoever. I guess, unfortunately for him, his wife and children eventually joined him in his countryside residence, but that didn't stop him at all. In fact, his personal manservant, Latour, became his like right-hand man, and he and Latour took their show on the road because, you see, Marquis de Sade, as a libertine, he was openly sexual. He slept with both men and women. And he would consistently not only have sex with his servant Latour, but he would also use Latour to procure young, unsuspecting victims as well. Also, I guess now's as good of time as any to say that, yeah, the Marquis de Sade was, by all modern standards, a pedophile. He would actually rape and assault children of both genders. So in 1772, he and Latour left the countryside residence. We need to go kidnap and rape and assault more people. Yeah, let's go. So while in Marseille, they poisoned four prostitutes with Spanish fly, sodomized them while having sex, and then one another in a drug-fueled orgy. And then they left. They fled, which was pretty much their MO. They would like hit up somewhere, rape, abuse, torture, and then just flee. They were sentenced to death in absentia for the sodomy, for the act of sodomy. And because of that, they fled France. They went to Italy. So what does Marquis de Sade do? He doesn't take his wife. He doesn't take his children. He takes his wife's sister, the one that he was promised to all along. He's like, nope, you and me, sis, we're going. He takes his wife's sister and Latour, his manservant, and they go to Italy. They flee. They go to Italy. And then, of course, naturally, de Sade began a sexual relationship with his wife's sister, because of course he did. They waited in Italy just for a few months when they thought the coast was clear, and then they made their way back to France. Shortly after crossing the border, though, they were all captured and imprisoned. Now, the two men, Latour and de Sade, escaped the prison 4 months later. They ended up making their way back to the countryside home, where de Sade actually hid out with his wife until 1774, so a couple more years. There is no further record on what happened to Latour other than him making it back to de Sade's residence. There is nothing on him, apparently, on historical record past that point. And then things go from bad to worse from there. De Sade's wife, Renée Cordier, becomes his accomplice. She would take part in orgies, rapes, druggings, and assaults. They even kidnapped, enslaved, and sexually abused together 6 children. On top of this, his wife was now on the, hey, let's post an ad for a servant and make them our sex slave game that Desaad had going for a while. So they now, together as a couple, committed many atrocities against their hired help. And most of their servants fled their residence, again, putting them on the local police's radar. In an interesting scenario, a father of one of these young female servants actually confronted the Marquis de Sade once. He walked up to him with a pistol drawn, pointed it directly at his face at point-blank range, and pulled the trigger, but it jammed. So again, the Parisian police were like, I guess we really do have to do something about this, like, pedophilic piece of garbage is raping and kidnapping everyone. So they devised a plan. They sent word to Desaad's country residence that his mother was deathly ill and had requested his presence. The actual truth of the matter, however, was that she had died months prior. But, you know, when word travels a little bit more slowly back in the late 1700s, when it's basically pigeon and horseback, so he had no idea. Plus, he was pretty much the black sheep of most of the family, so it's likely that no one else would have alerted him to that. So Desaad set out for Paris and was almost immediately apprehended, basically upon like entering city limits. So he once again was sent to jail. That prison was eventually shut down, and so he was moved to the infamous Bastille in 1784. And that was just 5 years before the French Revolution. But here at the Bastille is where he began to write. That's what he's primarily known for. And he actually started to write when he was imprisoned in the Bastille. A guard would sneak him tiny rolls of paper where he began to write Les 120 Journées de Sodom, or what English speakers such as myself know as the 120 Days of Sodom. The book was turned into a film, which is considered to be one of the most vile and difficult to watch films ever made. I love it. I have it. It is actually part of the Criterion Collection and is considered to be one of the most influential films ever made. The film is loosely based on the book, but the book chronicles 4 noblemen who decide to experience absolute sexual pleasure in the most filthy and degenerate ways possible. 600 of them, to be exact. The most shocking part of 120 Days of Sodom is where basically they kidnap a bunch of teenagers from the local village for whatever reasons, and they actually make them eat big bowls of their poop, of their feces. It is absolutely disgusting. But that film came out in the 70s. So in any case, on July 4th of 1789, Marquis de Sade was moved to a mental hospital in Paris where he would frequently yell out of his window to passersby on the street that guards at the Bastille were killing people. And he had no chance to grab his 120 Days of Sodom manuscript and thought it would be lost forever. They came and they grabbed him out of his cell. They moved him to a mental hospital in Paris, and he left his manuscript behind. And he, at that time, apparently considered it his best work. Just 10 days later, the single most important moment of French history happened. The Bastille was stormed and destroyed. And a completely random fact that the manuscript to 120 Days of Sodom was not lost. In fact, a man by the name of Arnaud de Saint-Maximin discovered and saved the manuscript just 2 days before the storming of the Bastille. So that is actually how 120 Days of Sodom was basically found, published, and is available for public consumption. And as everyone knows, the revolutionaries took over the government and executed a bunch of aristocrats, most of them, as well as a lot of their compatriots. They also emptied out most of the prisons and mental hospitals, which a lot of people don't know, because they were filled with revolutionaries or people unfairly imprisoned for whatever reason. And our boy Marquis de Sade got yet another literal get out of jail free card at that time. What does he do? I mean, he was part of that greedy, excessive aristocracy that the revolutionaries were railing against. So surely the revolutionaries would have sent him to the guillotine. Nope, 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 none of that. The Marquis de Sade was apparently so charismatic that he convinced them that he was a large supporter of their faction and even made several official appointments to office. He actually worked in various government offices. So also in 1790, aside from the revolution, Desaad's wife finally divorced him, and he ended up having a relationship with a young actress, Marie-Constance Quinet. And by all accounts, the two were actually madly in love, and she was very accepting of his proclivities, being like, oh, you want to go kidnap and rape someone tonight? Go for it. She just completely did not care. During this time, he also went back to writing, and his big claim to fame was actually two novels, Justine and Juliet. These were his big public claims to fame. They are two separate books that tell the stories of two sisters. They were rich aristocrats who became orphans due to their father's financial dealings. So they are both sent to an abbey where they are both sexually abused and corrupted by nuns. Juliet ends up being the libertine, and the book Justine chronicles her sexcapades and complete, like, crazy libertine lifestyle. Justine initially remained virtuous and fought corruption at basically every turn, pushing her further into violent sexual scenarios. So you have basically the two separate sides of morality. So Justine's book is called Justine, The Misfortunes of Virtue. And I'm going to read a synopsis from a 1988 New York Times article about Justine. And the article reads, quote, "Dismissed at 14 years of age from a convent in which she had been educated, she must defend her virtue from the assaults of debauchees who offer financial ease in exchange for sexual favors. She stoutly defends her moral principles and sees herself lowered to the position of servant in the household of an avaricious man who tries to induce her to steal from a neighbor. She refuses, and in reprisal, she is accused falsely of theft and imprisoned. By becoming an accomplice in an arson that kills several prisoners, she succeeds in escaping only to be raped. She takes refuge in the castle of a young Count de Brissac, a homosexual who turns out to be another monster, cruel and perverse. Because she refuses to help him in the poisoning of his mother, she is nearly devoured by the Count's ferocious mastiffs loosed against her. Picked up by another libertine, she is branded with a hot iron and expelled. What are we to make of this succession of tortures, whippings, flayings, incisions, burns, poisonings, vivisections, beatings, and humiliations?" And that, folks, is Justine's book. Both of these novels horrified the people of France. It horrified them. They were utterly disgusted. The books caused such an uproar that they were actually brought directly to Napoleon himself, Napoleon Bonaparte. And he actually personally ordered Marquis de Sade to be arrested and imprisoned without trial. And so he was. He was sent to the Sainte-Pélagie prison without trial, and at that time, he was 61 years old. In 1803, he was moved back to the asylum in Paris because he was found to be seducing and having sex with other inmates. His ex-wife and three children actually paid for his room, board, and maintenance. So, I mean, he had apparently one of the nicest rooms. He was able to bring anything that he wanted, have visitors at any time that he wanted. And he was actually allowed to continue writing, and he wrote stage plays. The public actually came to see them. He used inmates as actors and was able to actually write a lot of plays. Now, during this time, remember his young actress girlfriend, Marie Constance? So she pretended to be his wife and was actually permitted to move into the asylum with him next door. Like, she lived in a little private room next door to the facade. Next door to Desaad while he went and did all of his stuff. Like, I seriously cannot imagine that level of devotion that if your boyfriend goes into an insane asylum, you're like, I want to go live there with him, beside him in the next room over. I do not even know what that is. In any case, he didn't give a shit. He began having a sexual relationship with the 14-year-old daughter of an employee in the facility. And that affair lasted more than 4 years. The Marquis de Sade died at that asylum on December 2nd, 1814, at age 74. He had apparently been sick for quite a while, having violent pain in both of his testicles as well as his abdomen. And I will read a quick excerpt from his final will and testament. He wrote, "I categorically forbid the dissection of my body for any purpose whatsoever. I must pressingly request that it be kept for 48 hours in the room in which I die. During this time, an express messenger shall be sent to a firewood merchant to take my body in his care transport it in the said firewood wagon to the woods on my property, where I wish it to be placed without any sort of ceremony. Once the grave is filled in, acorns are to be scattered over it so that in time the grave is again overgrown, and when the undergrowth is grown as it was before, the traces of my grave will vanish from the face of the earth, as I like to think memory of me will be effaced from men's minds. Despite his request that his body be left alone for 48 hours before burial on his property, he was instead buried at the insane asylum, at the Sherrington Asylum, and his skull was then removed to be studied. He was given a very cheap, like a pauper's Christian burial at a remote site at the very far end of the asylum graveyard. And his grave was actually marked with a very small white stone cross, which is slightly humorous as he was actually a very militant atheist. After his death, his sons actually burned dozens of unpublished manuscripts. So there is a ton of work out there that never got published. However, most of his work actually survived, and the modern public has now has access to a wide variety of his written work. And I mean, the man, the myth, the legend, right? So here are five fun facts about the Marquis de Sade. Number one is his skull went missing and no one knows where it went. After his death, multiple doctors studied it, and one ended up actually taking it on a world tour to sold out crowds. I shit you not. After that, it just disappeared. People from all over regions would come to see his skull because he became so notorious. Number two, he obviously gave us the word sadism because look at his life and look at what he was into. Number three, in his book Philosophy in the Bedroom, the Marquis de Sade proposed the use of induced abortion for social reasons and population control. This is actually the first time documented in world history that abortion was discussed in a public manner, and likely the reason also why Western society became more familiar with such a concept. Four, his work influenced Nietzsche, Flaubert, and Voltaire. Again, three of the biggest philosophers and writers in French history, he actually influenced them. And then from a feminist perspective, it's actually very, 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 very interesting. A lot of the early feminists say that he was disgusting, that, you know, he was a rapist, a pedophile, and all of these things, that his work had no redeeming value whatsoever. And then there actually have been a lot of feminist academics who have come out and said that you have to look at it from a different lens, that you know, a lot of the women in his writings aren't the damsels in distress who are taken against their will, but women who come into their own sexuality and willingly take part in the debauchery and acts of filth. So just he has been just so completely controversial for so long. And it's actually really interesting. His descendants, because don't forget, he had three children. His descendants were so ashamed of him that they, you know, hid from public view. They didn't do interviews. They still actually owned in the family some of the properties, and they closed it all down. And that was until about 15 years ago when one of his descendants is like, no, like we should be proud of who he was and the mark that he left on the world, because obviously he left a huge one. France also, he was kind of France's dirty secret for a very, very, very long time. And now France actually openly celebrates him, his work, and considers him a national treasure. But that is, guys, that is the story of the Marquis de Sade. I wanted to throw that out there. I thought it would be a fun episode considering the subject matter that we are confronting. There will actually be a part three that will be coming out next week. And that is when we are going to talk about pornography, sex crime, and different paraphilias as far as the different researches that come out connecting violent sexual crime and pornography. And again, it's very interesting, tying it back to insects, that both the creator of insects and many, many, many serial killers have actually drawn on the Marquis de Sade and whatever work they just happen to read as being an influence on their thought process or sexual interests. So it's just, it all comes full circle, doesn't it, guys? So that is it for today's episode. I hope you learned something. I left out a lot of information. There's a good bit of additional information out there about the Marquis de Sade. If you are interested in him, he is fascinating. And what's even more fascinating is learning all of the different ways that he actually influenced society for the better at times, mind you, too. Influenced society in so many different ways that you may not even be aware of. there are those rare people throughout history that it's almost like a Forrest Gump, right? The movie Forrest Gump, where it's just over and over and over him hitting the most iconic milestones of American history throughout the time that he was alive. The Marquis de Sade was actually just like that as well. I mean, he knew Napoleon. He was there for the guillotines, the French Revolution, and definitely suggest, if you're interested, checking out 120 Days of Sodom. If you're looking for something a little less unsavory, check out Quills. It has Kate Winslet and Jeffrey Rush. That is the story of his later years while he is in prison. But that is it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. As always, if you're enjoying the show, you can check us out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil, where as for little as $3 a month, you can support the show, love the show, like the show, and get some cool benefits while doing it. I will see you next week with part 3 of this episode, and as well as a Lori Vallow update, guys, because I just have a feeling we're going to have some big stuff come out this next week. Beyond that, don't forget, if you are listening, follow our show, and don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Thanks again, guys. Until next crime.